Good evening. How's everyone doing tonight? I want to welcome you to Wake Island. Kate Durbin is on the show tonight. She's a visual artist, filmmaker, and writer. I discovered Kate's latest book of poetry called Hoarders through Dennis Cooper, who was on the show a few months back. And like usual, Dennis has not led me astray. As someone who watches a lot of shows like Interventions, Cops, 90 Day Fiancé, and Hoarders, I was thrilled that someone put a poetic container around the experience of watching reality television. In Hoarders, Durbin traces the associations between hoarding and collective U.S. traumas rooted in consumerism and the environment. Each poem is a portrait of a person and the beloved objects they hoard. In this conversation, we get into the religious and spiritual connotations of reality television, the martyrdom of Anna Nicole Smith, the redemptive aspects of the show Hoarders, and I actually, for the first time in my life, watched several hours of The Kardashians for this conversation, which we get into in some unexpected ways. And even if reality television is not your thing, I think Kate is a fascinating artist. And I'm sure after you hear this, you'll look at reality television as a medium in a more enchanted way. Also, listeners of Wake Island can order Hoarders directly from Wave Books and enjoy an additional 30% off by using the promo code WAKE_ISLAND. That is all caps, WAKE_ISLAND. And the link to do so is in the show notes. Make sure to stick around after the interview because Kate reads an excerpt from Hoarders. So sit back, relax, and space out to my conversation with Kate Durbin.
Funny thing. So yesterday, you know, I had asked you to email me some reality shows or movies or media that was important to you. And, you know, you had said The Hills and the Kardashians and E! Entertainment. And I was just like, all right, I'm going to do some research for this. I'm going to watch the Kardashians.
Great.
And the funny part is in my mind, I assumed that I had already seen it, that mm-hmm. I was like, well, I'm just going to watch it again. And I watched the first episode. I watched the last episode and I watched like a middle episode that's supposed to be like an important one. And I realized I've never fucking seen this show yet.
Oh, wow.
Somehow I know all these plot points. I know who everyone is. I know what their house looks like. It was weird. It made me kind of realize the importance of the show and how there's a few transcendent moments that happen in it. But I think one of the main ones is that the Kardashians are just such a part of our consciousness.
Right.
And I think when we use the word reality television, it's almost like we're using that word reality as a spell to remind us that what we're watching is more of an artifice than reality. But in the same way, it almost feels like this approximation to like religion, in the sense that both reality television and religion necessitate this like suspension of belief to heighten the medium and to really like buy into it and exist within the world that it's creating. Right. As someone that's like grown up with Christian fundamentalist parents, is this something that you've also caught onto, or is it something that resonates with you?
I love this question. Yeah, Oh, there's so many ways of thinking about it. But one of the things that I've been struck by with reality TV is that it is, you know, it always reminds me that, you know, we kind of create or construct our reality, right? And so like the Kardashians are a great example of that. I've long said that their sort of goal, or one of their many goals, is like immortality, because their images are so ubiquitous now. And like you were saying, like, you know so much about them already without even having watched the show, because they've just so saturated our culture, almost like gods or, you know, religious deities, or at least like signs and symbols, right?
The icons, for sure.
Yeah. And so I think one of the things that's always really interested me about reality TV is that because it's kind of self-consciously revealing its own construction to us as we watch it. I mean, no one's like thinking that thought as they watch it, but it is on some level. It reminds us that like we create our reality, like we create our culture. And you know, we also like live in reality TV now. That's something that I've said many times, like reality TV is our cultural condition because we're always on screens, we're always on Instagram and social media, and we're always recording ourselves and being recorded. And so, you know, there's this awareness I think we have in daily life now that we didn't have even like 15 years ago, of this kind of like idealized self or this construction of ourselves that we kind of send out into the world. You know, I think reality TV is interesting for that reason too.
I mean, it's fascinating for so many different reasons. And, you know, getting into your work has definitely forced me to consider a lot of the stuff that you just said. And it's also just kind of putting in the framework of this time. It's just crazy to think that like the core essence of reality television is actually in some ways more realistic than the discourse that we have around politics and mm-hmm. world affairs. And that part to me is, I think, the biggest like sea change that I saw while watching the Kardashians was that I remember when it was really popular for the discourse in the zeitgeist was more about like, is this real?
Right.
These girls are spoiled. This is bad. Like these kind of like, to me, like kind of pointless and superfluous conversations. When I look at it now, and I'm looking at something from like 14 years ago, this is actually more authentic than the world that we exist in now that we actually engage with on really serious topics.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think that if we're honest with ourselves when looking at reality TV, we can say, oh, I see myself there. And not just myself, but also just, you know, the conditions under which I am existing and doing politics and all these sorts of things. I mean, I think Trump was really someone who utilized, and of course he was a reality TV star too, right? He utilized mm-hmm. all of these various forms of media performance to his own benefit, including like some of our darker impulses, our tendencies to scapegoat, things like that, which ironically, you can see those same impulses in, you know, some of the ways that people have reacted toward reality TV, right? Or people on reality TV. Just like what you said earlier about people looking at the Kardashians and then, you know, oh, they're so shallow. Oh, they're so this or so that. But, you know, we're the voyeurs watching them, right? So I think it's all very, very complicated. But reality TV is such an interesting medium because it does make those aspects of our lives more apparent or more visible instead of hiding them.
I think because of where it's been in our culture, there's something really codifying about it in a sense that like, and this might sound completely insane to people that have been watching the Kardashians or reading think pieces on it to hear this guy that's like, I just saw them yesterday for the first time. But watching it, I was really struck by how they are the genesis of not only Americana, but beauty standards, aesthetics, wealth, dynasty, matriarchy, sisterhood, and actually even gender. And I don't know if you're still watching this show. I know it recently ended, but is this like something that you ever thought about while it was going on? Because I've actually never, aside from the beauty standard part, had never really considered that it encompasses as much as it does.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have, you know, that section about them in my book, E-Entertainment, which was my last book about reality TV. And I do think they are one of the most interesting reality TV families or superstars, whatever you want to call them, for all those various reasons. And I also think they've really kind of shaped the zeitgeist.
Totally.
So many ways that, you know, we both give them credit for, whether, you know, begrudgingly or, you know, not begrudgingly, but also in ways in which I think they haven't really been given their due. I think, you know, 20 years from now, looking back on the Kardashians, people will be able to see just, you know, what a impact they had. And again, you know, you can look at impact neutrally, right? It could be positive, negative, or otherwise, but they really knew how to kind of dial into the changes that were happening in the culture in terms of how, you know, tech and media were changing, and also kind of shape those to their own ends. And I just think, I don't know, there's so much to unpack with them, really. I plan to write about them again in the future because they are so incredibly fascinating.
I think you absolutely should. I mean, I would love to just talk about them some more, just because it's weird for me to, you know, have lived with these icons for so long, but not, and thinking that I actually knew about them, but at the same time, watching this show and it kind of confirming a lot of the things that I already thought, or I thought that I knew, but also I thought what was interesting to me is I never really knew how the timelines matched up in terms of pop culture. And,
right,
you know, I knew that she had made a sex tape and that was how she got famous, but I feel like when that had happened, she was so overshadowed by Britney and Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
And she had kind of gotten swallowed up in that mess. That was, I think, something that was more, had more to do with media and photography and privacy and a lot of different issues. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to see the first episode and wondering, like, where in this timeline does this start? And it was funny that they bring up the sex tape in episode number one, and she goes on Tyra Banks' show to talk about it. So it was interesting to see not only how they address it, and they address it as a family, which mm-hmm. I thought was really interesting. And maybe I think this is might be what some people might find problematic, but also probably fascinating, is that her mother at this moment is really starting to become the manager of the family, right, and corralling the daughters into this dynasty and shaping them and kind of pushing them into businesses. And in this weird way, Bruce Jenner is in the mix too. And he mm-hmm. just kind of seems like this, like, hapless TV dad that just the fact that he would become this icon of the gender conversations and the understandings that we have around gender, it seems like magic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's so much to unpack there. And I think Kris Jenner absolutely created that family and is someone who is, I think, unquestionably a genius at what she has created, which is the Kardashians. I mean, it's interesting. One of the things I've always enjoyed about them is that on the show itself, they have no qualms doing things like searching for themselves on paparazzi websites and just straight up, like, looking at that while on the reality TV show. And I feel like that is just so funny, and also just really speaks to kind of how they got to be where they're at. Because, you know, I think kind of before them, the idea would be that you, like, pretended either to hate the paparazzi, you know, have an antagonistic relationship with the paparazzi, or at least you wouldn't, like, look at your paparazzi photos and headlines while on your own reality TV show. And they have been more than willing to kind of, like, do that, perform that, you know, on the show itself, because the paparazzi made them famous. You know, it's this kind of, like, symbiosis, this relationship between the two. And I just think that that's just so funny and really brilliant.
Putting it back into the context of this time that we're talking about, which I guess is, like, the early aughts, they seem to be the first to realize we're collaborating with the paparazzi. We're not, like, outside of it. They're not objectifying us. You're helping us make money. We're helping you make some money on the side. And I feel like there's almost like a mafia-esque about them that adds a little bit of, like, coldness and intensity to the show, which is not, like, explicit by any means, but it's certainly there.
Yeah. I mean, it's very calculating, of course. I mean, it's like a media plan, but I think what's interesting, you know, is that fact that they don't totally hide it. And I do think kind of before that, the idea would be that you would hide.
That of course, yeah.
Or planting stories or whatever. And they're just totally nonchalant about it because it is just a part of their job, right? And how they have become who they are. And interestingly, one of the paparazzi that works on their show, I believe he's a camera operator who works on their show, mm-hmm. or did work on their show at one point, is someone who filmed their father during the OJ trial.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of the things he said was how polite Robert Kardashian was always very polite and respectful to him. Whereas, you know, he's a paparazzo. So, you know, people will scream at him. And of course, understandably, no one wants to be filmed by the paparazzi, or a lot of people don't. But he said, Robert always had, you know, a nice tie and was very polite to me. And so there's this moment on an episode where that paparazzo, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, but he gives the family a paparazzi tape that he'd made of Robert Kardashian, and they're all watching it crying. And you're like, wow, they're all a family in a way. It's so interesting.
Absolutely. And it's funny that you bring up the idea that there was whatever photographer, a paparazzi guy that worked with their father in the past and is continuing to work within the family now, because something that really occurred to me is that so much of the show and so much of the format is in fact a callback to history. We do have this desire for witnessing public performances of the self, as well as our compulsion to enact them. And it comes, I think it comes from something more than a need for attention. It's like this foundational aspect of art. So watching that show, I just thought it was fascinating, not just the show, but I guess reality TV in general, just to be able to trace back that lineage into history and realize that what we're doing with this is just a continuation of theater and mm-hmm. politics and the humanities, but it's somehow like blossomed into something more, but it's actually the exact same thing it's always been.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that it is the impulses we see on reality TV, and even like the impulses, you know, people feel watching it that are more negative, like schadenfreude or voyeurism or scapegoating, projection. It's all very human. Like, it's like you were saying at the beginning, it's has religious components to it. I mean, as soon as like we developed the capacity for, what is that form of thought where you could, you know, sorry, I'm going back to like really, really ancient history when we first developed like the ability to hold images in our mind, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It became this kind of like split, right? And I think TV is such an interesting part of that, because, you know, we're watching other people on the screen and we're projecting a part of our own experience onto them. And it's weird, right?
Yeah, no, it's totally weird. And it's funny that, you know, you brought up the religious aspect of it. 'Cause when I first thought about that, I started just thinking, I'm like, are there other connotations within this medium that are also religious? And then I realize, what do they all have in common? They have a confessional booth, and they literally call it the confessional. And it's, I'd say in some ways, like the keystone, or this is the aspect of reality TV that like helps gel everything together, is where they get the person usually drunk or just got into a fight or super emotional, and they literally put them in a confessional and they make them speak to the camera in a way that you assume that there's no person there, and they're speaking to like a godlike voice, in a sense that they're just speaking into the void, and they're overcome with emotion and this way to express the actual context of what's going on, and whatever they're, you know, whatever, it's real, it's not real, it doesn't matter. But that aspect of it felt so intensely religious and deep and kind of funny, and to do that in documentary would seem to it would almost seem like it was like breaking a rule or something.
Right.
But
right.
because this format is just so free and so mm-hmm. tied to consumerism in a way, you can do whatever you want. And I don't know, I just found it to be really fascinating.
Absolutely. I love the confessional as well. And of course, not every show has that, but a lot of them that I've written about do. And when I was writing those sections in the Kardashian, in my book, King Entertainment, I wrote about Kim's, there was a special called Kim's Fairy Tale Wedding, and it was when she married Chris Humphries. And they were married for about, I think it's 72 days. And so that special was very kind of ritualistic because it was about this wedding, right? And then the confessionals were also just these like very decadent spaces that were like kind of wedding themed
and like Baroque or something, right?
Yeah, they looked quite Baroque and yeah, very religious in many ways. And yeah, I think you're right that these kinds of rituals that we see on reality TV can definitely be tied to religion. And also like the this kind of ties maybe more to a show like The Bachelor or certain other shows, but like the things that we judge people for on reality TV can also be tied back to kind of like sin and, you know.
Yeah, the fundamental sins like jealousy and lust and.
Yeah, all those sorts of things. But I also liked what you said about documentary. You know, one of the things, I love documentaries, of course, and reality TV is born out of them, but you're totally right that like they try to kind of move toward this objectivity often, which is totally artificial, right? Like once you bring cameras into a space, people are going to act completely differently. And so it is nice that with reality TV, how highly structured it is, and because it's considered lowbrow entertainment, it doesn't have to try to feign objectivity or pretend to be objective. Of course, not every documentary does that. Many of them do not.
Right. But it is like a standard ideal that they all hold themselves to. And it is a wonderful thing, but you start to realize that by watching this lowbrow stuff that you actually, to a certain extent, almost get to a deeper truth. You get to like a more collective sense of truth through right. all the machinations of TV and consumerism and just the fuckery and the performance. Like right. it all that fakeness is actually stuff that we do that is really meaningful to us. So to right. take it out sometimes actually removes us from the reality of who we are.
Well, and when we watch a reality TV show, we don't expect it to be all.
No, not at all.
And it's interesting. I've noticed, you know, there's been a lot of documentaries released on channels like HBO lately. And I mean, there's documentaries all the time, but something that I found kind of interesting about documentaries that deal with particularly like crimes is that people, if it's called a documentary, people will read it or watch it as if it is the truth, mm-hmm. Which I think is like very dangerous actually, because editing is everything, right? And so
yeah.
you don't know what's left out. You don't know how something has been edited or shaped, and all media is edited. All books are edited. All documentaries are edited. All reality TV is edited. But thankfully with reality TV, we don't even ascribe it that level of truthfulness. So we can, like you were saying, kind of watch it with open eyes and other discoveries, deeper truths about, you know, what we value and who we are and our, maybe some of our impulses we don't want to like name and claim, all of those sorts of things, and kind of be revealed to us without that pressure of like, this is the truth, the narrow truth.
I think a big part of that is because reality television is tied to so many more ethereal feelings like beauty and family. Right. Whereas in when you have these true crime documentaries, they're tied to something that's incredibly biased and incredibly subjective, which is our legal system. Right. So people think that because there's a, you know, there's a courtroom component to this thing, or there's some sort of punitive aspect to this story, that it must be true. And right. I'm like, well, that's the most like bullshitty thing we have in America. We all kind of know at this point right. that the courtroom is the biggest theater, the biggest stage that there is. Like the stuff that we're seeing happen there has very little to do with reality. I mean, we hope that it does, and it should. Right. You hope that the person that is guilty is actually sentenced and punished if that's your thing. But like,
right.
It's actually not. So there is this very like odd dissonance between the two.
And we can be so easily convinced, right, by what we see. Seeing is believing. That cliche is existing for a reason. Mm-hmm. And like music can convince us, and you know, pulling a quote out of context can convince us. Just the omission of certain information can convince us. One of the things I really do appreciate about a lot of reality TV is the frivolity of it, the fact that it is kind of, it deals with important aspects of our lives, you know, marriage, family. And I also think with a lot of the shows that I wrote about in my last book, E! Entertainment, you know, The Hills, The Kardashians, The Real Housewives, something that I was struck by in writing about those shows is I think part of the reason why they are so denigrated is that they're about women and women's relationships with other women, which tend to be seen as catty or shallow or just not as important. And so like, that's something too, I think, to think about with reality TV is I feel like it's maybe kind of a feminized genre. Sometimes, and that's another reason why it's seen perhaps as being trash, kind of in general. Of course, it's not that simple, but at least with certain shows or certain subgenres, I think that that's definitely, you know, part of how it's viewed.
No, I think you're totally right. I think that part is somewhat glaring because the idea that there are certain shows or certain documentaries where you're even allowed to know that there is an omission mm-hmm. is already placing it into this other kind of stranger context. Whereas in reality TV, you don't have the excuse of saying, oh, this was an omission. This isn't like, you know, whatever. You're not able to kind of like retroactively take something back and say that it was or it wasn't real. You have to confront the idea that the people that you're watching are human and some of them are liars and that some of them might be looking out for themselves. And that's what we're all doing. I mean, it's not that we're all like selfish liars all the time, but we are looking out for ourselves. But
we can be selfish liars. Yeah. Well, and the shows often deal with highly competitive scenarios. And that's something that I find really interesting because especially in the United States, we live in this very kind of increasingly precarious economy, a very individualistic culture, a highly competitive culture. And so it makes sense that like our shows would reflect that kind of ruthlessness and where, you know, these figures on the shows are pitted against one another. And that's something, you know, when I was writing about The Real Housewives that I thought a lot about and kind of put into the short story I created around them was just the way that they are pitted against each other on the show and the way the kind of camera and the scenarios that are set up, the camera's gaze and then the scenarios that are set up all kind of work together to create those situations.
And it's regional on top of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's like the regional quality is something that you probably noticed in Hoarders too. Like I'm really fascinated by these repetitions that you'll see across the United States, the same, you know, kind of archetypal story, but then also like little regional differences too can also be interesting.
One of my favorite aspects of reality TV, especially the ones that I like Interventions, is just knowing the city and kind of identifying those regional things. But, you know, before we get into that, you know, we were talking about the ruthless nature of, or the ruthless competitive nature of these characters. And you know, just to bring it back to the Kardashians, the one offshoot of that show that I did watch was Rob Kardashian and Blac Chyna's show. Did you ever see that?
You know what? I haven't seen it.
Okay. But you know who he is in terms of the show and pop culture and stuff. So I guess for the audience that doesn't know, Rob Kardashian is like the one male. He's the brother. He's definitely like, I wouldn't even say he's in the pecking order. He's just a little bit like just out of the matriarchy and a dynasty that's around him throughout mm-hmm. the years. He starts as like a good looking young man. And over the years, he starts to gain a lot of weight. He becomes like withdrawn. And I only know him that way. I used to work at the Daily Mail, by the way. So like, I know I only know celebrities at their absolute worst. Oh. I know a lot about them at that moment. But what I thought was fascinating about seeing the first episode and kind of seeing him as like part of the family and like included and is just like, as this person, is that he actually became, I feel like, some sort of modern archetype, which I think still fits into this like religious context that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And he seems to represent someone that left the nest, someone that left the dynasty and was just picked apart by outside forces, picked apart by vultures.
Yeah, Rob's story is pretty sad. I have a hard time kind of watching him because it brings up a lot with my own family. There's a lot of substance use and mental illness. And also actually, I'm sure we'll talk about this in a minute, hoarding as well in my family. And so shows like Intervention or Hoarders are a little bit closer to kind of what I've experienced in my own life with my family. And I agree with you. I think Rob's story is sad, and he's really someone who can kind of reveal the heaviness and, you know, just the difficulty of dealing with fame. Britney Spears as well. Like I often say, to be famous is a curse. And of course it's not only a curse, like obviously many of the Kardashians are thriving or appear to be thriving right within the space of fame and also kind of in control, right? This idea of controlling their image and working within these systems that exist within our world that are kind of inherently very ruthless in a lot of ways, such as, you know, the paparazzi system and the media spectacle culture and all of that. And Rob is, I can relate to this. Like I wouldn't be able to handle it myself, you know?
Yeah.
I can see the suffering. And I'm sure there's more suffering that we don't see.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's the case with any family that is experiencing, you know, just the intensity of fame. I mean, it's absolutely traumatic. And I think that's just kind of objectively true, even if someone figures out how to manage it. I think it requires like ninja skills, both emotionally, psychologically, and physically to manage and handle fame.
Just from like getting into your work and watching this stuff, I started to just think a lot about how many visual moments we've had within pop culture that were not intended to be art, much like the Kardashians, but are actually just incredibly intense and moving and also just have solidified themselves into the consciousness in a way that only art and paintings had before, or like serious news photographs, like the Challenger spacecraft exploding. And, you know, I'm thinking specifically about like Britney Spears shaving her head, Anna Nicole Smith being painted up as a clown and being like videotaped. Like, do you have a great moment or maybe not great, but a significant moment in pop culture that was not intended to be art that was just really meaningful and special for you?
Well, you know, I wrote about that Anna Nicole moment in E! Entertainment, and I created these series of monologues from that video of her, and mm-hmm. then I perform it sometimes. It's one of the most intense and difficult artworks for me to perform.
Well, tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, so I perform each monologue, and each monologue. So if for anyone listening, the Anna Nicole Clown video is quite complicated, but this was sort of near the end of Anna Nicole's life, and she was really not doing well and addicted to pills. And it's speculated that her boyfriend, who was also her lawyer, who also happened to be named Howard K. Stern, but it was not Howard Stern, the shock jock. It was a different person. he was kind of feeding her these pills, or at least like very complicit in her addiction, and possibly killed her intentionally, thinking he was going to get her money, which is something that happens to famous people or rich people too. But so, you know, in this video, he's filming her and she's very out of it. She's pregnant. And then she also is kind of near the swimming pool. And there's a little girl there who's her niece. And the little girl is painting Anna Nicole's face with clown makeup. And one of the things that kind of happens in the video is that there's this toy baby doll, and Anna Nicole keeps treating it as if it's a real baby. So one of the things I was really interested in doing with this video was kind of playing with that line between the real and the artificial, and kind of revealing that, you know, there's a deeper truth here, which is that, like, this is a woman in trouble and no one's helping. Everyone's just watching her downfall, right?
And it's so aggressive.
It's very aggressive. I mean, this was used in court, actually.
But in the public, it was seen as something kind of funny and almost like an addition to her reality TV show.
Yeah, because she had had this reality show. And that was one of the things that Howard K. Stern said about it, was that she was just acting for the show and that it wasn't a real tragedy. So when I perform it, I have someone do the makeup on me, and I perform each monologue. And I really, what I did was I pulled out all of the dialogue from it, and I do each person in a row. And the last two I do, so I do Howard K. Stern, who's also kind of the voice of the camera. And then I move into Riley, the little girl, and she's kind of this voice of like innocence and also like speaking the truth, like, you know, she's really worried about Anna. And she's also like, that's a doll. That's not a real baby. And so she's also raising these kinds of existential and metaphysical questions. Mm-hmm. And then I do Anna Nicole's kind of very tragic monologue, which is super hard to do emotionally. And then it moves in at the end to the doll itself crying for its mother. So it's pretty intense to do, but you know, one of my goals with that piece was really to pull the art out of that video, which I agree with you that, you know, I still might see it as art in some way, or at least moving toward art. It reveals something really specific about the moment we live in. But I also think, you know, for something to be art, that framing and some moving and changing and pushing the material into a space where, you know, that emotional resonance can be really directly felt is essential for something to become art. That's got to be like one of the hardest pieces I've made out of reality TV. And yeah, Anna Nicole's story just really makes me sad.
Yeah, I agree. There was something especially tragic and deep and compelling about her that felt like it almost felt like a fairy tale or something.
Yeah, like especially the old Grimm's ones that don't end well.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, she Britney Spears, a lot of these, you know, women from the 90s were, the public is so complicit in their.
Totally. I mean, oh. I think that's so fucking crazy. Like yeah. That we'll never really be able to acknowledge that or absolve anyone of the fact that we like drove these women to total madness so we could watch. Like, right. That's very, very, very dark.
Right. You know, there's been a lot of conversation lately about it, which is good. Mm-hmm. But I have found that in some of those conversations, the blame has kind of tended to fall on the paparazzi. And I have some issues with that because, you know, it's the paparazzi would not take those photos if we didn't watch or crave the images. And, you know, paparazzi are often, you know, immigrants. They're trying to, you know, survive in America and make money. And so, you know, those are human beings too, which I think, you know, often their story is just completely erased, or they're just seen as, you know, maybe walking cameras or something. You know, and I think, you know, one of the things that I hope my work does is help us to mostly just look at ourselves when it comes to our relationship with certain celebrities or celebrity culture or fame culture, not in like a purist moral way where we end up just going back, circling back to reality TV is bad or something like that, but some self-awareness, you know?
No, I think you do that, and you do it in a very compelling way. And I guess this would be a good opportunity to start talking about your book Hoarders, because just keeping with this religious theme, this is a show that I actually know very well and have been watching for a long time. And it's funny that this show also has a religious component that runs through it, which is the redemptive part. The whole show is kind of built on redemption. So for people that don't know, this show is about people that hoard just everything in their homes, whether it be animals or furniture or tchotchkes or trash, and the structure is that somebody comes in, usually at the request of a family member, and they try to clean this person's house out. But there's just so many things kind of happening that are, they're on camera, but I think they're also off camera, in the sense that there's this intense tension between desire, isolation, mental illness, shame, fantasy, trauma, escape, dysfunction, consumption, delusion, capitalism. The most visual component is that there's just intense like friction between decay and a sense of needing to preserve everything. So tell me about what was the most compelling part of this show for you that made you want to write this book.
Well, I want to say a little something first about the redemption element.
Please.
I agree with you. It's so religious. It's very Judeo-Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, growing up in Christianity, I grew up in fundamentalist Christianity. So I had a very, like, very religious upbringing.
And what is that, just to be specific?
Well, fundamentalist Christians are just like the strictest Christians, you know, like they have like the most kind of strict beliefs, and there's a lot of, there's kind of a real sense within it of like shutting yourself off from the world and from popular culture and from seeing the world as like sinful and dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so I was really in kind of a bubble growing up, particularly my younger years and somewhat my teenage years. But then I also went to a religious college, so I guess it continued for a while. But yeah, in Hoarders, that redemption element, I really wrestled with that in my book because I felt that it existed. Well, it was complicated, right? Of course, everyone on this show is really in need of support and in kind of dire distress. But at the same time, the redemption element is so quick, right? This idea like that if we clean your house out, you're fixed, you're good. It really bothered me. And it also felt very artificial to me, like it existed for the viewer to feel more comfortable with what they were watching. Because
yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so I'm sure you noticed I completely removed that part from my poems and instead wanted to go into the relationship between people and objects and these very nuanced, complex ways of seeing objects in a culture that produces so many objects. I mean, we have so much stuff right now more than at any time in human history. We have more stuff. Humans have made more stuff than ever before. And we also have more commodities and, you know, single-use products, products intended for obsolescence, for things we call trash, than at any other time in human history. And so this idea of looking at objects differently, which many people who hoard do, was very interesting to me, and I wanted to listen to their stories. And so this was a show, you know, that I had not watched before, in large part because there's hoarding in my family and also, you know, mental illness and substance use. You mentioned Intervention earlier. That's another show that's really hard for me to watch because of my family. But I did know a lot about hoarding as a disorder and about the topics on the show, but I hadn't really watched it. But yeah, I really was primarily interested in going into this relationship and letting each figure that in each poem, so each poem is, you know, a character poem or a portrait, one person and the objects that they hoard kind of in conversation with each other. And the objects, you know, hold many things. They hold individual traumas, cultural traumas. They also hold like potential and, you know, promises and beauty. And, you know, I really felt in working through this book and writing through this show that I was able to see a lot of beauty in all of these objects, including like in decay and in trash and in, you know, things that someone might call gross. I didn't really find them gross. I found them just, I don't know, very rich and very complex. And of course, sad and painful, but I really kind of moved away from any sense of grossness, which I think is really, you know, something that when you watch it as a TV show, some of the editing kind of plays to that way of looking at some of these piles or hoards and kind of portraying them as othering or gross or whatever. But I was really interested in you know, I said to myself, like, these people love these objects so much that they don't want to part with them, even though they're causing them a world of trouble. So I want to look at those objects with attention and care instead of just clearing them out, which is what, you know, the show moves toward.
As somebody that watched this show, read your book, and then watched a couple episodes before we talked, your book, Hoarders, is in a lot of ways this mashup of observations from the show, as well as like this accumulation of dialogue from the show. And what I like is that the elements that you write about, as far as the objects go, like, they don't necessarily illustrate what's being said, but they sketch out this other dimension of the home and of the person. These objects, they're also an extension of the person and their home. And their home is actually shrinking while also becoming this completely insular universe that the person has created, that they want to live in, that is like this like nest that's giving them a sense of comfort. When you watch the show and you notice that a person is like committing to hoarding, do you think that they're in some way synthesizing the objects into their identity and becoming this new sense of reality, or trying to synthesize all of that into a new space or sense of reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that sort of came through for me when I was working on this was just the simple truth that I think we don't think about on our in our daily lives, which is like we surround ourselves with objects because those objects stand in for certain ideas or beliefs or feelings about ourselves or what we want reality to be in our daily lives. And, you know, I think everyone does that to some degree. Like, why, we don't need paintings on our walls, right? They don't serve any kind of functional purpose, but they give us a certain feeling, right? They make us feel a certain way about ourselves, about our homes, about our lives. And so I think that that's something that is you know, sort of generally true. On the show, though, I really would have a hard time kind of pinpointing one sort of reason for hoarding, and one kind of overarching kind of meaning or significance to it as an activity or an action. And in fact, one of the things I really wanted to do in the book was kind of allow it to be almost existential in a way. Like, this is an action that people do, right? And they do it within this larger culture, this country we're in right now, the United States of America, where we have all these objects. And so there's a lot that we can kind of unpack there in the individual relationships between people and their stuff, but also just the stuff itself, right? The objects themselves in the poems, I feel, also had a lot to say about, you know, their existence and, you know, their place within individual people's lives, but also like within just this particular moment in this country. And I almost started to feel like, as I was working on this, that I didn't understand what objects were. By the time I got to the end, I was like, what are things? I almost started to feel like the sense of animism or something, because I realized that our relationship to objects are so complicated, like way more complicated than I had ever imagined before I dove into this project. And I don't know, it's very complicated, I think.
But I think that word animus really speaks to, once again, this like spiritual component that we're kind of digging into with these shows. Because when I watch Hoarders, I really wonder how inherently American this show is, and if it exists in other countries, because it almost feels as though the people and the objects are like dissolving into like one endless enclosure within America. And when I see it, it almost seems like I'm being forced to walk through this haunted house or this dark ride or this museum of America or of what our country has become.
One of the things that I was struck by again and again was like this question, which it's not supposed to be like a functional question, right? Hoarding is not a functional behavior. This question that came through to me is not a functional question, but it was like, well, what about all this stuff? Are we just supposed to put it in a landfill? Like, you know, this desire to preserve it and rescue it was very compelling to me. One of the things that I was struck by in these poems when I was writing them was just the desire to stop time and to stop loss and to stop death, this sort of existential desire, going back to the idea of a quest for immortality, right? And I think that is part of the consumer promise. And not every poem in Hoarders has to do with consumerism, of course. It's much bigger than that, but there is, consumerism is a part of it. And it's also a part of, you know, US culture, like you were saying. So I think you can see that the poems comment on it, because a lot of the objects that people are going to have in their house in the United States are going to be related to consumerism, and also to like the fact that we have so much like excess packaging, shrink wrap, Ziploc bags, like all these sorts of things that if you go to other countries, you know, they've done away with some of that or reduced it. But I do want to say, you know, hoarding is as a, you know, disorder is very human, and it's worldwide, and it's not just in the United States. But if you're going to look at any form of mental illness within a context of a particular place and time, it's always going to be in relationship to that place and time, right? We're all affected by our environment, as well as, you know, genetics and trauma and all these different kind of factors that make us who we are and shape our relationship to the world. And so I think that's in many ways why that comes through in the poems, because they do take place here. And they also take place in a country where, you know, you mentioned the word isolation also in relationship to this show. Like, one of the things I was struck by that really broke my heart was you know, people feeling they need to go on a reality TV show to get help, because what help are you going to get in this country? Like, we don't even have
healthcare,
socialized medicine, right? And also, we really value this fame culture. So, you know, a lot of people have talked with me about this book and the voyeurism aspect of it, the voyeurism aspect of the show, I should say, and the fact that the show is, you know, kind of going into the lives of people who are in trouble. But, you know, something to also think about, I think, is the fact that people want to go on Hoarders because everyone wants to be famous. And so I think that that's something really interesting too, the fact that we live in a culture that values fame so much that, you know, and also where you can only get support and help in some cases by going on a reality TV show. I mean, people go on The Bachelor, right, to get married, like
to find love,
right? To find love, but then also to pay for their wedding, you know?
And yeah, of course.
It's like these forms of surveillance are like now embedded in our medicine, in our, you know, in our marriages, in our weddings. It's like, it's very embedded.
I think so much of the show, it's about a sense of reclamation, and reclamation is a huge part of spirituality in general. I mean, I think a lot of people get into it for that reason, for the essence that provides. And when you watch Hoarders, it's so much about wiping the slate clean, as well as punishing someone for punishing their family in a way where the punishment is actually also the help.
Right. So
it almost necessitates having this like poetic index to help you process the reality of us, right, and where this show exists.
And it's so morally muddy. I mean, nothing morally muddier than Hoarders. And, you know, that was part of also what interested me in writing about it, was to kind of go into that space. And I think as someone who did grow up in this fundamentalist background, you know, embracing the morally gray and the morally complex aspects of our existence and experience have been so kind of important to me as I moved away from religion, because I'm really interested in the highly nuanced aspect of the truth, or how highly nuanced the truth is, and how difficult it is to truly understand, you know, who we are as humans and what the heck we're doing here. You know, religion gave me all those answers when I was a kid, so I've had to do a lot of unlearning. And yeah, I think Hoarders is absolutely a very morally complicated show. And then, you know, it's also a morally complicated thing to write about it as well.
When we watch this show, Hoarders, we objectify people that have become very similar to the objects they collect. So right, there's just a very specific trauma and then a very specific type of shame and embarrassment that comes with losing it all from trying to gain too much, which I think in some way is maybe the essence of being an American.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's really true. And I think, you know, one of the things that was really important to me to do, I kind of already mentioned this, but was to treat the objects with care, because the people on the show really projected themselves onto them. They projected their trauma onto them. They felt thrown away themselves by life, fate, America. And in many ways, they had been thrown away. And so they rescued these items, right? And so to look at the items in a new way with care, as well as, of course, to look at the people with care, was sort of the impulse that I had in writing this book, a way of looking at it differently than you might when you watch the show on television.
Do you think that reality television has plateaued? And how do you like envision its evolution now that we're watching and performing for one another on this like really broad and personal level through TikTok? And
right,
you know, we obviously had Donald Trump, who was a reality star, and he like tried to like canceled TikTok, which I thought was just kind of so funny and ironic, because it's like, this is the same like format that made you famous. And now there's like young children or young people that are like utilizing it for their own sense of fame and self and whatever they get out of it. But I also feel like the medium of reality TV has plateaued to a certain extent. I really felt that actually watching the end of the Kardashians, where I was like, damn, you guys have really done everything you could really do with your family. Like, I don't know what more could happen or like what more mythology you could build outside of just making this like about your brand, which I think is like just not very exciting.
I don't think they're done at all. That's my prediction. I think, they've had all these children now. So it's like, speaking of their quest for immortality, like the children will be the next generation on TikTok and on their own shows. But, media does always evolve. And I think, something, it's interesting to think about reality TV, like say in the 90s, when I first saw The Real World, it was this kind of like edgy subgenre. And then it became much bigger. But as you were saying, like now we kind of recognize that we're all living on reality TV all the time. So while I wouldn't say that that makes the genre obsolete, like I think we're always going to enjoy, looking voyeuristically and with curiosity into the lives of other people through, these mediums. Perhaps, it's a good point in time to kind of expand our definition of what reality TV even is. Like maybe just even thinking about the fact that, when you go on Instagram, that's your reality TV show,
Right. It's only a minute long, but it's still a reality TV show.
Yeah, totally. And the Kardashians are on there too, right? They have these huge platforms on social media, and that's just as much a part of their reality show as, the show.
Arguably bigger than the show.
It is bigger, yeah. And I think, that is both incredible and, if you don't want to be on reality TV, it's disturbing, right? Because it's like we have to contend with the fact that we're more and more surveyed in our daily lives and more people have access to looking at us than ever before. Like, it's not really possible to hide if you want to hide. And so just facing that reality, I think, is probably important.
I'm Marlena, the worst hoarder on planet Pink Sands Yankee Candle. My house is like a bomb went off at Walmart. Shattered seashell wreaths, tangle of rainbow LED hummingbird wind chimes, tie-dye lion tapestry with a hole in the lion's face, Drew Barrymore flower home collection plates with half-eaten Luna bars and dead wasps. I was a fashion model for many years in Europe, moth-eaten Balenciaga dresses. Then my husband and I fell in love. Photo of young Marlena and a man hugging in front of a private jet, her hair in pigtails, her midriff tanned and toned. Our relationship was storybook. Ceramic plate of two chickens pecking, smeared with crystallized honey. After a few weeks, he proposed. Sun-bleached hippie boho fabric lovebirds. I felt like we stepped onto a magic carpet and just flew. Cost plus world market decorative pillows, glitter elephant throw, crushed banana chips, blackened bananas, crumpled sunset magazine pages, stuffed panda and lotus pose on Marlena's bed. But after our daughter was born, my husband started dating other women secretly, dozens of Louis Vuitton bags under the bed. When I found out, I just wanted a divorce. On the front door, keep out absolutely no solicitors, this means you. Beware of dog sign, card that says, Our Lady of Lourdes pray for us, and underneath, in shaky handwriting, help me God. I felt suicidal, but I had my 2-year-old daughter to think of. Photo of Marlena's daughter in pigtails and big Chanel sunglasses playing the piano. That was a very hard time for me. Completely lost in the bathroom, dusty makeup brushes, goopy concealer, murky bottles of Dior nail polish, melted cherries on snow Yankee Candle with gray hairs stuck in the wax. I started collecting Whole Foods 365 products. My kitchen sink is totally full. Organic Turkish apricots, cheddar bunnies, sea salt avocado oil, canyon cut potato chips, Himalayan pink salt popcorn, cookie dough collagen protein bars, organic goji berries, blue magic cashew milk, majestic sprouted hummus. My hoarding has caused a terrible rift between me and my American Girl doll with a destroyed face. She started taking my things and throwing them out without asking, so I put all of her old things in plastic bags. Little Mermaid Ariel doll smeared with marker, Easy Bake oven filled with old crumbs, Little Miss Makeup doll with red cheeks and lips and chewed fingers, clump of My Little Ponies. I said she wasn't welcome at the house anymore. Dirty lips pillow that says, kiss me. I want desperately to change. Marlena digging in neighborhood trash bins, a flashlight strapped to her head. She pulls out Chase credit card statements, styrofoam food containers, Starbucks reusable plastic cups. But I don't like when people throw things out that still work. Marlena testing a Sharpie on an electricity bill. When they put trash in the recycling bin, I move it to the trash. Marlena carefully moving a Chiquita banana peel from the recycling to the trash. When plants in the neighborhood are not properly watered, I do. Marlena facing a tree, pouring water on its roots, her slender legs and her thin neck, her gray hair. Even though this is trash to most humans on the planet, it isn't trash to me. Marlena slowly reaching into a giant pile of unopened Whole Foods items on her kitchen floor and lifting out a bottle of water. Marlena somehow pulling a clean cup from the eruption inside the sink. Marlena pouring herself a cup of water to drink.